Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Lisa Fantino, where to begin? Well, first of all, she spent more than 20 years as an award-winning reporter at New York City's two top radio news stations, WCBS and 1010 Winds, and she was also an anchor at the NBC radio network. Lisa has interviewed a whole host of bold-face names, Mick Jagger, Walter Cronkite, Yogi Berra, to name just three. She's also an attorney with an international general practice that provides legal services to both individual and corporate clients. Lisa also started Wanderlust Women Travel, a concierge travel company that, despite its name, is open to everyone and offers customized itineraries all over the world. Even though she's been just about everywhere, Lisa says her soul is always happiest in Italy, which brings me to Lisa, the author. Amalfi Blue, Lost and Found in the South of Italy, is her travel memoir, written after she packed up and moved there for love. It's been at the top of Kindle's bestseller list since its release 2 years ago. That was followed by Shrouded in Pompeii, a political thriller in which she introduces the Mickey Malone mystery series. Lisa, welcome and thanks for joining me
today.
Thank
you for having me.
So let me ask you straight out, do you get bored easily?
Yes. How can you tell?
Well, geez, I mean, you don't sit still. A little ADD going on there,
well,
professionally.
A good reporter has to have that, doesn't she?
Well, you've reinvented yourself several times. Start at the beginning, will you?
Radio was always in my blood.
Why?
I don't know. For my second birthday, I got a reel-to-reel tape recorder from my parents and a typewriter when I was two.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, but I used to enter all kinds of radio contests. From a young age, I would have them call with the correct trivia answer. I met Fred Robbins. I'm dating myself now, but I won a date, or I was a finalist for a date with Kookie.
And Kookie.
Sunset Strip, after the Zimbalist Jr.
Oh, my gosh. Yes.
So radio was just in my blood.
Did your family not have a television?
Captain Kangaroo, when I interviewed him at Disney World and told him he was my idol, he looked at me. I had kangaroo pajamas. So I've been a broadcast junkie for a very long time.
Were your parents that?
They were the furthest thing from it. That's why they would have to be my voice, because I was too little to pick up the phone and enter all these broadcast contests.
Isn't that wild?
But they nurtured me and they encouraged me. So, I mean, I used to make War of the Worlds newsreels and everything on this little reel-to-reels.
So you majored in broadcasting in college?
Yes, double major. I went the English lit route in case I needed to fall back on education. So I did that. When I got out of school, I was teaching full-time during the day, doing radio in Westchester at night.
On the air?
On the air.
You know, when I started in radio a long time ago, and I don't know, I think I'm older than you are, and it doesn't matter, but there weren't a whole lot of women on the radio. There was Allison Steele in New York City, who was this really sexy-sounding disc jockey.
Yes.
And that's kind of it, right?
Right, correct.
And so there was a part of me that felt that, at least for me, I hate that expression, the right place at the right time.
Yes.
But I think that it applied. And do you feel that way, too?
Yes, definitely. And coming up, also, I had good male role models as news directors who encouraged me to go make my chops out on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were a lot of people when I got to the network level that had never been on the street. And I felt that being on the street polished my news skills a whole lot more.
We have to think on your feet pretty quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
You started out as a reporter. Or
yes.
Did you start out as a writer?
When my first commercial station,
yes.
I was an anchor.
You were
an anchor and a reporter.
Clearly, you had to have a good voice.
I would hope so.
And so then did you move from upstate?
It was in Westchester. That
Westchester,
was my first
right.
commercial
you said
station.
Westchester. And was it difficult for and so was mine at WVOX in New Rochelle.
Oh, I was at WFAS.
Okay, in White
we
Plains.
We were competitors.
This is getting a little inside baseball. But for me, making the transition to New York, you know how in those days they said, you know, you're going to have to go to Iowa and cut your teeth on Iowa before you come back to the Big Apple. And I guess for both of us, it was really kind of lucky because then I went to KTU. Which was, the disco station.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, well, what I did was I saw that I wasn't advancing where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the city.
Mm.
And I wasn't getting out of FAS. Not that I wasn't happy there. It was a great training ground. But I decided to go for my master's. And that's when Syracuse opened doors for me. I went to Syracuse University.
Your master's in what, communications?
Yes, broadcast journalism.
Why? Why did you think you needed a master's when here you were, you know,
it was
doing
to make,
the job?
It was to network. I had gone to Pace undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
I got a very good education, but there was no networking as far as broadcasting goes.
Oh, that's really interesting that you felt that you had to go on.
Right. I mean, NBC, it was like almost open entree to NBC once you stepped out of Newhouse at that point in time.
So is that where you went to the radio network before you went to the two all-news local radio stations in the city?
Yes. When I graduated Syracuse, when I came back to New York, I was hired at WINS.
At 1010 WINS?
Yes.
As an anchor or a reporter?
A reporter and a writer.
Did you cover stories or were you basically interviewing celebrities?
Celebrities was my own TV chat show on cablevision. And when I went to NBC, I was more of an entertainment reporter. But no, I was covering hard news.
Fires and, yes. and shootings
yes.
and things
and
like that.
Chasing Mayor Koch around and then Giuliani.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you like it?
Oh, I loved it. Are you kidding? Yeah.
And why aren't you still doing it?
Managerial differences.
Mm-hmm,
it's at
mm-hmm,
one
mm-hmm,
of the stations. Mm-hmm. And then 9/11 hit.
You worked on 9/11?
I was supposed to. If you remember correctly, that was primary day in New York. And I was always the election night producer, cutting tape in the tape room. And the election got postponed that year, if you remember, after 9/11.
Sure.
So I wasn't supposed to work until that evening. And being in Westchester when the planes hit, it was like being cut off from the world. You couldn't get across the river.
Mm-hmm.
So I never went back to work, and that was my last scheduled shift.
Wow. And for me, I was in New Jersey, and I couldn't get across the George Washington Bridge because it was closed. So they
right.
sent me to Jersey City, where a lot of the walking wounded. I went to a hospital mm-hmm. and just interviewed people. Yeah, that was a stunning moment. Right?
Actually, I had tried every police and fire connection I had. Can you just get me across the bridge and I'll get downtown
mm-hmm.
because I knew the newsroom was crazed. They weren't even answering the phones
sure,
at that point.
Sure.
But I knew they needed bodies in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't make my way across the river.
I think for me, the next day, they let certain personnel cross the George Washington Bridge. And I had, you know, press credentials.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me to go to various hospitals where people were standing outside with pictures. Have you seen
yeah.
so-and-so? Wow, it was crazy. So then you go to law school? Is that the next? I mean, how about switching gears?
That was plan B. Plan C? Yeah.
Why'd you want to be a lawyer?
Well, covering a lot of murder trials, covering criminals from when they're arraigned. I mean, sometimes I was with a criminal more than their lawyer was.
Huh.
From their arrest, their arraignment, through their conviction or acquittal, and then on appeals. I mean, so sometimes you stayed with an accused or a convicted person for 2 or 3 years. And I saw in court a lot of good lawyering and a lot of bad lawyering. And, you know, being a news reporter, even in a city like New York, is sort of like being an actor. You never know where your next gig is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have to have plan B because you never know if plan A is going to take you through to the end of your career. So my wheels were always turning when I was sitting in a trial. And I would
thinking that this can't last forever for you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's really an interesting thing.
Definitely.
Because I thought it was, well, lots of times we didn't have control, you
mm-hmm.
know, over our fates.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you were, quote, doing a good job, you could stay there forever. No?
As long as the news director didn't get changed.
That's true.
I started going to law school the same day I started working at CBS. And CBS was gracious enough to work my shifts around my law school classes.
Did you go to school at night?
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, I was going to law school. I was working part-time at a firm. So thank God I had that because when 9/11 hit, I had a job to fall back on. And then I just started nurturing my law practice.
But you didn't graduate from law school and start your own practice, did you?
No. I was working part-time for a firm.
For a firm. Now you've got journalism under your belt. You've got law under your belt. And now you're in the travel business?
Let's put it this way. Things happen in your life that aren't always planned.
Duh.
and my dad passed away about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And after that had settled, I needed to escape. So I escaped to Italy because that's my happy place. I love
You'd been before.
Yes, and not in many years. It's sunny most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
How could you not be happy there?
Mm-hmm.
So I went there, and it was on my last night coming home.
This was a finite vacation.
Yes, it was a one-week vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Went to Rome, then went down to the south through Naples and found my way to Sorrento. And it was like a scene from a movie. The day before I was leaving, I met somebody on a ferry. And he asked me to dance literally on the deck. And
just because.
Just because. And that was the beginning of a 5-year love affair that turned into a book.
Well, let's not go to the book first.
The travel company was the entrepreneur in me decided I needed a way to be able to keep going back to Italy frequently, A, with a write-off, and B, so that I didn't wear out my welcome there, because an American can only stay for 90 days in the EU. And it has to be 90 days. They don't tell you this in the regulations, but it has to be 90 days followed by another 90 off before they'll let you back in.
So it's 3 months there, 3 months off, 3 months there.
Yeah.
And you wanted to stay for that stretch?
I wanted to afford
in terms of time?
As an attorney, most of the time you're not seeing your clients unless you're in a courtroom. So I did a lot of my work on the phone. I would sit in my living room in Italy at night, and my clients would never know where I was.
Oh, that's really wild. But was a lot of your practice defending them in court as opposed to,
no,
you know,
a lot of it was a lot of it was transactional work.
Right, like drawing up a lease
correct.
Or something
yeah,
like
if
that.
If I had a major litigation or a trial upcoming or going on, I could not have done that. But at the time, my practice was mainly transactional.
Mm-hmm.
And transactions are done via email, the internet, and telephone.
Were you your own firm?
At that point in time, yes.
It was just you?
Yes.
And that sustained you? You could juggle those balls in the air? You could be in Italy and you could also mm-hmm. work in your firm?
But that's why I also developed the travel concierge business, so that I could cater to high-end clients who wanted a customized trip to Italy, London, wherever.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Fantino, who has been in radio, in the law, in the travel business, and is also an author. We're going to get back to the travel business. How were you able to do this as a sole practitioner? And what time is this?
Yeah, this isn't that long ago. This was 2009.
Okay, that's okay. Recent.
Right. And so people were still into blogging.
They still are.
They are, but it's now become Twitter. Okay?
Okay. Okay.
All right? But people were still into blogging, trying to get their voices heard, their opinion out there, and everyone has an opinion. The journalist in me decided to start a travel blog. This way I would have something to write about to nurture the travel habit I just got. And the entrepreneur in me said, I've got to monetize this. And doing it with backlinks and ads for, you know, sponsors wasn't going to make me enough money. I knew that. So I decided to start a travel concierge service. And we became a full I'm the staff, became a full service travel agency. And so now—
Did you have a lot of clients?
It started with a fellow journalist from CBS who said, I want to go to Italy for uh-huh. 2 weeks. Can you help me? She was my first client. We planned her entire trip from soup to nuts.
Uh-huh.
And then just, you know, it
so
spread.
So snowball?
Yeah. And then I developed more of a following on Twitter. A lot of my first clients who were strangers just found me on the internet because of my expertise in Italy. Italy primarily was the country that I was known as a specialist in, because that was where my blog articles were mm-hmm. focusing on. But then someone called me and said, can you handle 2 weeks in Thailand? I said, no problem. So, you know, what I tend to do when I'm booking a destination for the first time, because I don't like to book clients into destinations I've never visited. Even if it's a 5-star hotel, it could be 3-star service.
Had you been to Thailand before?
No, I never. But I was honest with my client. And I told them that. And I gave them half off what my normal concierge fee would be for a trip like that. And they were willing to roll the dice, and they were happy with everything.
Are you still in the travel concierge
business? Yes. Yes.
Where does your chutzpah come from?
Probably my mom. But you know what? If I ever write this memoir, it'll be the story of my two grandmothers. Both of them came here from Italy when they were young children. One was 8, one was 18. The 18-year-old was from a wealthy family in Sicily, but Sicily was falling apart at the time that she came here. And she was educated. When she came here, she had nothing. Long story short, she fell in love with the gardener and was disowned by her father, who was a well-known engineer out in Amityville and the Great Gatsby kind of mansion era. Mm-hmm. So she was out on the street with 5 kids. She started a bakery out there. Then she came to the Bronx, bought up a 1-square block area, built a whole bunch of retail stores with an apartment building on top. And this was a woman who just left the cushy life she had grown up with in Italy and in Amityville. Then my other grandmother came here at 8. Unfortunately, her father didn't come with her, so she came with my great-grandmother was essentially a single mother here, living in Lower Manhattan. She knew that she had to fight for everything that she wanted. When she was married in 1926. That was a time when women weren't really liberated, so to speak. I mean, she wanted to drive. She wanted to be able to take her kids to the beach. My grandfather wouldn't let her get a license. She saved up her money from a part-time job, bought a car to take these kids to the beach. So, I mean, it's
so it's genetic. In your DNA?
Yeah, exactly.
You, in a sense, were your own cheerleader?
Oh, yeah, but my mom has supported me in everything. She would chase down the rock stars with me when I was going to cover a story for NBC. My mom would come with me. You know, if it was like a 3 or 4 hour ride to get to the gig, she'd be in this car with me and we'd just head out.
Was that a pretty cool part of your life in terms of interviewing the big celebrities?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the day I started at CBS, much of the audience may be New York-based, mm-hmm. but CBS's headquarters is on or was on 6th Avenue in a very tall building at the time. It was called BlackRock.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a big building. Yes,
yeah.
And it was gorgeous. And there were steps that went down to the lobby before mm-hmm. you actually got in. And I was just excited because my mom had been at CBS as an administrator when I was a kid. Now I'm going to CBS and I'm going to be a writer and a reporter. And I walked into the elevator and Walter Cronkite was in there. And to me, yeah, I'd interviewed Mick Jagger, I'd interviewed Paul McCartney and all these other people, but there's Walter Cronkite working mm-hmm. with me. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and he said, "Hey, kid," he goes, "where are you going?" And I wasn't a kid at that point, but I liked the fact that he thought I was. And I said, "I'm starting today at 88. And he went, "Well,
that's its place on the dial."
Exactly. And he said, "Well, welcome to the farm." And I was like, "Oh, my God, I've made it. This is Walter
Cronkite."
You were
hanging on his pants leg as he's walking out of the elevator. As you look back, that was an exciting moment. But you're really not easily intimidated, are you?
No, or easily impressed.
Uh-huh.
To easily impress me doesn't mean you have a jet to take me away to San Francisco for the weekend. It means that you're a loyal person, you're dependable, you're trustworthy, and that takes a lot.
I mean, Walter Cronkite impressed you, I mean,
yeah,
obviously.
Well, yes.
Yeah, let's put him in a special category.
Yeah, exactly. And he was my career icon.
Mm.
I mean, I think if anyone meets their career idol, mm-hmm. you know, then it would be a monumental moment in their life. But I've dated rock stars. I said that in my memoir. And
who'd you date?
I never kissed and told before.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, but I mean, they're names that you would know. And
what was that like?
It was boring after a while.
All about him?
No. Because the guys that I went out with, I wouldn't have been attracted to them if it was all about them.
Did you see yourself one day, you know, walking down the aisle
yeah,
with somebody?
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. Because they're not walking down the aisle kind
so
of guys, generally.
So you're a little naive.
Starstruck, I guess, romantically starstruck. You know, uh-huh. they're not the kind of guys that barbecue on the weekend. That way.
uh-huh. But that must have been, well, glamorous, you know, from
yes.
the outside looking. I mean, would it impress me,
sure.
do you think? So you're involved in this travel company, but you've got this connection out of Italy in the form of
our love relationship, yes.
And as I was going through your memoir, it was a little bizarre because the guy lives there and you live here. And yes, there's the internet and there's texting and whatever, but it's really not the same thing. How did you convince yourself that this was, and I'm using this term in quotes, a legitimate relationship?
He came here. Oh, he did. He would come here for months at a time also.
You would be working and he would?
I'd be working and he'd be going to the gym or whatever. I mean,
uh-huh.
he's Italian. They work out.
Okay. So you had a great body, but
yeah.
not enough, huh?
Yeah, no. I think it was a learning experience for me. I think I met...
How old were you when you first met him?
50.
And did you see this as being, oh, I hate this word, your soulmate?
Yeah, but I hate that word just the same reason that you, it has a negative connotation for me.
But did you saw
yes.
yourself kind of going
yeah.
off
we
into
We never had one fight. I think the problem was him leaving Italy. I think that's eventually what it boiled down to. We wouldn't have lasted 5 years if it was just a quickie vacation fling.
Mm-hmm.
But 5 years went back and forth. I mean, you know.
You saw him, what, 2 or 3 times a year?
Yeah, but for months at a time. It wasn't like for a weekend at a time.
And you could afford to go there and do your work
yes.
from Italy.
Yes.
What did he do for a living?
He's a great chef. That's what he was trained to do. He actually served President Clinton when he was in the Italian Navy and stationed here. He's an excellent chef, but work over there is very difficult. The unemployment rate in Italy for the young is at 40% right now.
Mm-hmm.
So he was working the ferries because that's where his family had its roots.
So he could afford to take these, you know,
well,
these...
come October, the ferries don't run. And at the time that we were dating, he didn't have a job in a restaurant either.
And was he the same age as you?
No, he was much younger.
Was that an issue?
No. Again, I don't think we would have lasted 5 years if that was the issue. I think it was basically him leaving Italy.
Did it end on a mutual note? Did you both realize this is just, we can't pull this off?
Yeah, I think by the end we did. I
mean, and you we're knew still you were friends. Not going to go. You were not going to move there.
I knew I couldn't live there full time. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, the romantic notion of being able to live there and have a virtual law practice or any other kind of business that's essentially based in the United States, you still have to make FaceTime to grow your business. Mm-hmm. And that's not going to happen when you're sitting in a penthouse apartment in Sorrento. It's just not. It's not realistic. So there also wasn't enough opportunity. And to be perfectly frank, as much as I love Italy and I love living there 3 months at a time, I can't wait to get back to New York at the end of the 3 months. There are just many modern conveniences that we take for granted on a daily basis, mm-hmm. including good transportation. If I lived in Sorrento, which is where my apartment was, I would have to say a prayer in order to get to Naples, which was the next biggest city. Now, normally that would be like a suburban New York commute, 45 minutes on the train. But sometimes the train breaks down and you're stuck in the tunnel for 3 hours. Or sometimes the train doesn't run. Or sometimes they take a strike in the middle of the day.
Sure. So these are the times that try women's souls.
So even if I was able to get a job with an American firm with an office in Italy, I don't know how that I'd be able to commute. It's not a logistically convenient country to live in.
So where did Amalfi Blue come from? How was that born? Your memoir? I mean, is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, because it came – what happened was the first time I went there was a very rainy spring. And I started having these conversations with myself. He would work in the daytime. I didn't really have friends per se.
Wait, let me interrupt you. When you first went there, this was when you first met him?
I first met him in 2008.
Okay.
I didn't start staying there until on a regular basis till 2011. So we were commuting for 2 years.
Okay.
Then in 2011, I started staying there for prolonged.
Like 3 months?
Yes.
Okay.
And so when I first went there, I had business contacts because of the travel business, but you don't hang out with your business contacts during the business day. So I was very lonely. It was raining. And I started having these conversations with myself. And as a journalist, a career journalist, my conversations turned into a journal on my iPad. And again, the entrepreneur in me said, I've got to do something with this just to keep my mind going because I'm going crazy here. So I started pouring out all of this emotion, and it is an emotional journey. I may not be for everyone, but it's my emotional journey, and it's my truth, so to speak. People don't believe the story, but every single word in that book is the truth. So it was experiences and emotions I had felt at the loss of my father, then with my mother surviving a stroke. I had gone through a very rough 2 to 3 year period, and now I'm in Italy and I'm all alone. So I was exploring life at that point and trying to figure out what it was that I wanted, how I wanted to focus my life for the second half of it. And it turned into a book. So Amalfi Blue is sort of a play on words. The Amalfi Coast has this wonderful blue water, and it's just magical. And I liked the color, and I liked the way they spelled it B-L-U in mm-hmm. Italian. And someone who's very dear to me, who's big in publishing and in magazines, Bob Guccione Jr.
Bob Guccione's son?
Yes.
As in Penthouse.
Yes, and the son had started Spin Magazine. Mm-hmm. We're very good friends. Mm-hmm. And I was bouncing a lot of writing ideas off of him while I was writing this book, and I told him what I wanted to call it. And he said, don't go with the B-L-U. He said, go with the B-L-U-E. He goes, because you were... It's a double play on that word.
You were sad.
Yeah. Uh-huh. He said, and then you came out of it. So he goes, it's sort of like you came from a blue place and now you're in a better place. So I went with the traditional English spelling on.
Was that a hard book to write?
No, it just flowed. And it's a very small book, but it packs a lot into it. It's categorized as a travel memoir because of the location that it took place in. But I think it's more than that. It's more than you get to a point in your life where you make different evaluations and you focus on what's important to you. And I think it's a journey of my life that came at that point, but it's based in Italy. So there's a lot of things that, you know, the comical things of me being frustrated at trying to get my clothes dried with an Italian dryer and the manual's written in Italian and things like that. So there are a lot of travel memoir aspects of it, but it's sprinkled with life lessons along the way.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Lisa Fantino, who has been in radio, in the law, in the travel business, and is also an author. I don't write, so this is kind of something I've always thought of, and I wanted to ask somebody who does. Is there a presumptuousness in terms of being a writer? Where does one come off to think that they can write a book? And I don't mean that at all in a nasty way.
I know that. But for 25 years, I think my career speaks for itself in the fact that my writing was noticed. And it was recognized by associations that give awards for such things.
But you're not writing a book.
I'm not writing a book, but that means I know where a period goes and where a comma goes and how to structure get out my strunk and white, which is unheard of these days.
Exactly.
And know grammatically how to put a sentence together.
Yeah, but interviewing Mick Jagger, to just play the devil's advocate, could be far more interesting than hearing about what happened to you in Sorrento.
Correct. And I wrote the book for me. Happy that it's sold and that it's been at the top of the Kindle bestseller list for 2 years periodically. It fluctuates just as any other
sure.
book. But, I mean, that is... To me, that's an accomplishment. That's my life story, and it's being validated. Whether the people like it, whether they can relate to it or not, is one thing. But the fact that they're taking their time and their money and they're reading the whole thing says something.
Absolutely.
You know, they could stop at the first page. They don't have to read the rest of the book if they don't like it.
So then how was the second book, Shrouded in Pompeii, born?
Now that is...
Because that's a departure from what you were doing.
Yes.
That's fiction.
But that's fiction, but Mickey Malone is a New York-based gutsy street reporter. And Mickey Malone was actually born during my stint in law school. I started my first book... The same day I started CBS, the same day I started law school, it was one big bonanza week in my
life. Yeah, really?
But that book will never see the light of day. I finished it. It took me the 4 years that I went to law school to finish it. I learned a lot about writing, how to structure. In the meantime, I've talked with other authors. You're right. It's different writing a 60-second news story than writing a 350-page novel. Yeah. But... If I had Mary Higgins Clark on my chat show, I would pick her brain, you know. Here's somebody that I read, that I enjoy reading.
Sure.
What makes me want to read her and how does she get me to want to read her? So I would pick her brain with things like that. And I think I structured – Mickey Malone was always with me until she was born again and shrouded in Pompeii. But I didn't know how this story was going to evolve particularly. The story came to me – when I was on a press trip for Amalfi Blue. It was during one of my stints in Italy when the book had first been released in 2013, and the U.S. Navy has a huge base. The 6th Fleet is stationed in Naples. It's also now a joint force fleet base, so that NATO is there, the Army's there. It's a very large presence. And it was National Poetry Week, and they have an American high school on base for the kids that are there. So they invited me to do a full week's worth of presentations to the kids, to the parents.
Oh, very cool.
And book promotion in the NX, you know, food court, et cetera. So I was there for the full week, and I had to take this long train that I told you is not too reliable, going back and forth between Sorrento and Naples, and Pompeii is smack dab in the middle of them. And my brain just started going, and I started imagining.
Well, your brain
things.
Never stops going, apparently.
No, very rarely, even when I try to go to sleep. But I said, what happens if I kill off a naval officer and his body's found in Pompeii? And that's exactly where it was born. And it was funny because all the sailors and all the officers and everyone who would meet me in the food court would say, well, when it's made into a movie, you have to come here because they have a cinema on base and it's right in the NX. And they're like, we'll have the premiere here. And they were staging the whole thing. The guys in the service were great. So they were feeding, you know, my imagination as to how I was creating this story.
So we'll hear more from Mickey Malone.
Oh, this was just the first
one.
Yes, I'm working on Mickey's second adventure now.
Well, I can't believe it. We've run out of time. But I get the distinct feeling that we'll be hearing plenty from Lisa
well,
Fantano.
Thank you very
Do you have,
much.
Have anything else up your sleeve that you might want to
well,
share?
Well, Mickey's second adventure is going to be in Cornwall in London.
Which is where you'll be traveling.
Yes. Mickey likes to travel just the way most reporters like to travel.
That's wonderful. So you think that that's kind of what you're going to focus on, among the law, travel, and
writing.
And writing.
Writing's my passion. I mean, so even if I retire as a lawyer at some point in time, I could keep writing.
That's great. You've got a lot to say to people. You know, you never were just never shy.
No.
You know, I'm going to do this?
No.
You're your own best, what?
Publicist.
Publicist. Touche. Lisa, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, truly.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.